Welcome to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Each episode will explore DIY bio, citizen science, and medical device security with guests from the healthcare, cybersecurity research, and biohacking communities. Hosted by Nina Alley and Bo Woods.
Welcome to the podcast. We have Joel Cardella from Thermo Fisher. How are you doing, Joel?
I am doing great. Thank you. How are you both?
Can't complain. It's a bright and sunny day outside.
And we're in here.
This is terrible. But we're with you. So that's sun enough.
In your windowless room. I know. I'm sorry. It's very
you
sad.
You are the sunshine of my life.
Oh, that was so
sad. Oh, yeah. I know.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm going to go on
We're
going to
do acapella later.
This is going to be a Grammy-winning podcast. The first one ever.
That's not a bad idea.
Okay, yeah. Let's do it. How do we submit to the Grammys?
Should we sing something? What do you want
to
sing?
Yeah.
What's on your new playlist?
Well, you know, my go-to song is Mac the Knife. Like, you know that, right?
Oh, nice.
I don't know.
Oh, you've never heard me do Mac the Knife karaoke?
Give us a few bars.
A few bars?
Yeah.
Oh, that shark bites with its teeth, babe, and it shows them pearly whites. Round the corner comes old Mac Heath, babe. And he keeps it out of sight. I'm getting it all wrong, but yes.
Nice.
So that's my go-to song.
I've never heard that song.
Mac the Knife? What's wrong with you?
Oh, man.
It's a classic. I can sing them like super old salsa music.
Do it.
No.
Everybody's sung except you. Nina, it's up to you now.
No, we were singing All the Leaves Are Brown before. I'm totally down to do that.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Together as a group. Great. Look, now we have...
All the leaves are brown. And the sky is gray. I went for a walk.
And began to pray. That's all I got.
Or on a summer's day. I don't know.
Oh.
Make up your own words.
He goes to a church at some point. Okay.
Does he?
Right?
I feel like there's a story in that song. I've just never paid attention to it.
He hated wherever they were. He was cold. He went to the church. He was like, I just want to go back to California where it's warm and I'm happy. And that's why California Dreaming came about.
There you go.
Mamas and the Papas.
Boom. Dropping knowledge bombs. Nobody even knew I knew that.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That's amazing. So, Joel.
Yes, sir.
We came here to have a sing-along, but clearly, you know, our voices aren't in tune, so maybe we should talk about security stuff instead.
Probably a good idea.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about you, why people would care about hearing you?
Sure. Well, I don't know that people would care, but I'm Joel Cardella. What I do is I work for a company called Thermo Fisher Scientific, and we are a scientific device maker, which includes medical devices and all kinds of wonderful things. And I'm having an amazing time as the person who's running the product security program, learning about IoT and the space that we are in. For a while, I wanted to get into IoT security. I've been involved with security since about 2010. I've been in IT, 25, 30 years, a long time. But IoT really fascinates me because it is like a Wild West. This is a frontier. I really feel like I'm in a covered wagon. Any day I'll die of dysentery, and I'm just waiting for that to happen, right? So this is like, all the games I played, the Civ and Oregon Trail, Civ and Oregon Trail, and all the awesome things that I played, I get to do in real life now as we are trying to do the things we're doing, right? Knock down barriers or design things or create patterns that we can do stuff from. Honestly, the most interesting and challenging thing I found when I first took this role is that there wasn't a lot out there to learn from. And it was really kind of a shoot from the hip kind of exercise. So that's really how I feel. It's like this is this Wild West. And anytime I hire somebody, I always tell them that. I'm like, if you're comfortable with structure, this is not the place you want to be. We are flying a plane and we're building that plane as we're flying it. And it's crazy. But it's also very cool. And I find that the challenge absolutely fascinating. And I really hope that we can make some good headway together because I can't do it alone.
Mm-hmm. So Thermo Fisher, from conversations that we had, did not necessarily have a lot of security when you started. and you started building up on that. So tell us a little bit about the experience that you had when you first got there as SNL.
Sure. So Thermo internally, if you were to come into the enterprise, you would actually find a remarkably mature security organization. Before I came here, I was actually a consultant, and I did a lot of consulting for very large companies and very small companies. And really what I was doing is I was evaluating their security programs. And when I walked in the door here, I was absolutely shocked to find that this was the program. It was sort of the gold standard that I was trying to apply to all the clients that I was consulting with before that. And it was actually kind of surprising. And the interesting thing about it is they'd had a few years to build this mature enterprise security program, but had never thought about IoT security. And I think that's really where the journey starts, is when you realize that IoT security is not enterprise security. Just as, you know, we hear the term IT is not OT. Mm-hmm. These worlds definitely intersect. They somewhat overlap, but they are very different worlds. And so they realized a few years into their journey that they needed something that focused specifically on the products that they sold to customers. And once that product is sold to a customer, the customer is absorbing the risk of whatever that thing is into their network. And that is the big challenge. That's the, you know, how do you manage that? How do you maintain that? How do you have conversations around that when you've got a reliance on, say, a vendor when you're doing things with products? So that was the really fascinating thing to me when I walked in the door was, wow, we do a lot of really great stuff internally. We need to be able to do this externally as well. The challenge is there are no good patterns to follow from enterprise security. Now, there's great control sets, there's great frameworks, there's all kinds of stuff that we can use to guide us, but it's just not the same thing. And so that's really kind of what was the attraction for me, is it wasn't the same-o, and I could use knowledge that I had, or an experience that I had picked up from the past, and apply it to this new thing, you know, IoT security.
So how long have you been at Thermo?
So I have been here a year and a half as of now. And the first few months of my job really was figuring out all those things I just told you, because mm-hmm. I didn't really know where to start. I didn't really know what I had. I didn't have a team. I had me and an intern. That was it. And so, you know, for the intern, I gave him some work and I said, here, I want you to do these things and try to find this information. And luckily, he was somebody who had been with the company for a while. So he had some institutional knowledge that I could pull from. And then the first person I hired, she came from our risk organization within corporate information security. And she had a strong risk background and a strong institutional knowledge as well, having been with the company for 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I was able to build on the skills of the people that I had with me to try to ferret out this information and determine, you know, where are we at? What do we have? Because really, we started with nothing. It was really kind of a ground zero exercise. And so building those structures and thinking about what do we want to do? You know, the first question I wrote down on the whiteboard that I had in my office was, what is product security? Can we define this? And I had a really hard time with it. For a long time, I had a really hard time with it. I have conversations now with colleagues or with customers, and I'm well able to define it now because we have direction and we have things that we're doing. But it's very difficult in the beginning to get your bearings. And what I have to say is I have huge shout out to make to Rob Suarez at BD, because he's somebody's name that I found on the BD website. And I happened to meet him at a thing that was going on in DC. And I walked up to him and I said, hey, you know, Rob, I've seen your name and stuff, and I'm really interested in what you're doing. I just started this job. Can you help me? And he absolutely mentored me for a long time, giving up a lot of his time to talk about the challenges that he had and the different things we went to. And in the spirit of paying it forward, what I want people to know, especially from this, is I want to do the same thing. So if there are people out there who are struggling, I am more than happy to share my success stories with you, to share my failure stories with you, to tell you what we're doing right, what I think we're doing wrong, and really, again, try to forge the spirit of community, because I realized some time ago that this is not a lone endeavor. You can't be a lonesome cowboy on this landscape. You have to come together, right? It takes a village, a biohacking village, for example.
Hey, there you go.
Well played.
Good segue. I like it.
Right.
It's been a common theme talking with folks for the last few years about security, of like, we've got all of these people who are doing really good things in isolation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And sometimes they don't understand each other. They're not talking to each other or what have you. I know that it's to some degree changed over the last 5 or 6 years. But the more it changes to me, the more I see where the issues still are. So I wonder if you see the same thing, like seeing some of the benefits and those changes, but also where do you think, so let me simplify the question. What do you think have been the successes over the last few years at bringing those communities together? And what do you think we need to do as an ecosystem, healthcare ecosystem, to accelerate that change, to get to where we need to be?
So I think that the big thing for, I can probably only really answer from my point of view, right? But I think that the big realization for me was the whole concept a few years ago of mic drop security, where something would happen, you know, the mic would drop, that's it, we're done. Every conference was a red team conference. And so it was really difficult to learn how to programmatically approach the stuff. And that's how I think of everything. My whole career has really been building organizations, building programs, building teams, building processes. And so that's really where I come from in the whole space. And so those programmatic structures just they don't exist in a vacuum. They don't exist in the wild. You do have to build them, and you have to pull stuff from the community and elsewhere to do that. So this whole idea of mic drop security is going on, and I think that people started to talk about it, and they said, look, there's not enough here. You know, we know that this stuff is vulnerable, and it's not enough for us to point out that it's vulnerable. We have to start talking about how can we make it better? How can we make it not vulnerable? I'm sure we'll get into this later, but it takes a very, very long time to take something in its current state and turn it into a different state. A very long time. I mean, I have personal experience with this here and elsewhere. But if we can look at something before it's born and make it into something that's good by the time it is born, right? So as a product being released to market, for example, that gives us a leg up on a lot of what this is. So in my mind, when I kind of forecast and look at the future, a lot of this stuff that's going on right now is really not the stuff that we need to be focusing on. We really need to be looking forward and saying, how do we get these things to a market that will sustain and support the things that we need to do for this, while at the same time building on legacy foundations, right? That's the real balance. And so we can talk about legacy all day. Yes, we can talk about the fact that, you know, Windows XP is a terrible solution, but it's still being deployed, mm-hmm. Okay? Our company still deploys it in certain cases. So when we look at something like that and we go, okay, if there's a need for this thing and it's built on these foundations that we think are shaky foundations, let's really look at what it takes to get that next generation thing in a better state, and put some time into whatever it is right now, right, foundationally, and try to fix that as well. So one of the conclusions I came to was, it's not just about what I can do as a manufacturer, it's about the conversations that I have with customers, with colleagues, and with the community. And so I will talk to customers about compensating controls, for example. If they are going to buy a thing, regardless of what that thing is, whether it's from me or somebody else, and we know that thing can't be managed well, then really it's in our best interest to go talk to that customer and say, how do you manage your network? How do you do these things internally? Let's help you get to the point where you can lower the risk that you're absorbing from these things as an overall risk equation, not as an individual risk profile for each event or each device, right? And so that's a strong part of it. And then in the community, it's learning from the people that are out there, going and visiting and talking and mentoring and all of these other things that are happening. I can't see a way to do this without doing it together. And I'm going to say that a lot because I think it's an important point. But if you contrast now to those last few years, like you initially asked, then that's really what we're doing, is we're coming together more, we're talking more, we're acknowledging more. And then for me, the trick is we got to flip the switch, stop thinking about things as an enterprise equation, which we have more or less figured out, and start looking at things as what they are. IoT is different. It's a snowflake. It's a whatever it is. How do we manage a thing like that, right? Take a concept like vulnerability management. Vulnerability management in an enterprise is a much easier equation because we have control over the devices that we're managing, versus IoT security, where I no longer have control once I give it to a customer, but I still have some sort of of maintenance or custodial work that needs to be done on that thing. Those are the same concept in theory, but two different approaches. And that's what we have to really look at, is how do we approach this in a new way, in a different way of this whole solution of X, right, for IoT.
Do you think doctors and patients would be surprised? I mean, so we were just out at the CyberMed Summit in San Diego. Mm-hmm. One of the neat and unique things I think there was that it brought together doctors and hackers and medical device makers and regulators and patients and kind of everybody. And I know, you know, from some of those conversations that, you know, this isn't the same topics and ideas aren't always on everybody's mind.
Right.
So what do you think is maybe one of the most surprising things to particularly doctors and to patients about medical device security?
The most surprising thing? I mean, honestly, I don't think that they really think about it, because when you talk about cybersecurity to, you know, I'll say a layperson, so it's not as insulting, right? Really, in their mind, this is all part and parcel to what they're buying. This thing shouldn't have a cybersecurity flaw. It should be fine if I'm buying it. Or maybe put in a different term, it should be safe if I'm buying it, right? And to some extent, I agree with that. I think that there is absolutely an assumption of safety or an assumption of security that should be made when you are doing anything, purchasing a device or bringing it into your network or putting it on your body. You know, you're extending your trust that that thing isn't going to do something abnormal, right? And so that's really where we do that dance, is we want to bring the awareness of what these things are to those constituents and say, look, there are things that you need to consider with this. And, you know, when I hear about the topic of like cybersecurity disclosure with medical devices, I think that's a great way to start. I think it's great for us to tell people, this is a connected device, it's connected to the internet, that means there is some risk, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of have to weigh that, though, against, again, a normal non-security person and having it scare them into not adopting that technology because they think that, you know, somebody's going to be able to kill them from half a world away because of this thing that's on their body. I mean, it's a really difficult equation. So at the end of the day, for me, you know, the thing that I want to bring awareness to is just the fact that this device is, right? It is a connected device. You need to understand that your connected devices do have some risk inherent in them, just as, you know, you have the risk of any medical treatment or medical surgery. So being aware of those things, in my mind, is the most important thing. I'm a big proponent of separating cybersecurity documentation out from other documentation in a product. And we're working on this here internally. It's a big push for me for the coming years to very specifically and explicitly spell out the cybersecurity implications of a given device so that information can be consumed. Maybe it's consumed by my customer and they can pass it on to their customers. Maybe it's passed on directly to the consumer who would take advantage of that. But, you know, like any user manual, right? It's going to be up to the individual person to determine whether or not they're going to absorb that information and do something with it or not. But in my opinion, it needs to be information that is explicit, that it's obvious, and that way somebody can choose to just do something with it if they want to.
So what gives you hope when you kind of think about the things that are going on or the things that are in the near-term future?
Well, science. I work for a sciences company, and I see the amazing things that are happening. You know, I like some of the problems that they're trying to fix, for example, you don't even think about are problems until you realize, oh, yeah, that's a thing. For example, we're working on a solution that will take a process of evaluation and shrink the window so treatment can begin sooner. And, you know, if your typical process takes 48 hours and you got a technology that you can bring to the market that'll do that in 4 hours, mm-hmm. that's huge. That literally can change somebody's life. It could save somebody's life. So when I see those kinds of things, I go, yes, absolutely. What can I do to support that product, device, whatever it is, process, and make it happen and make it real. So for me, like, I'm very interested in the science behind what we do with medical devices, the sort of royal we there, and how that is changing things. Now, one of my catchphrases or my call those mottos, whatever, is that innovation will always outpace cybersecurity. And if we see it as a race, we're going to lose. We will never, ever catch up. We will never win, which means we have to kind of reframe that. It's not a race. We have to look at innovation. We have to look at cybersecurity, and we have to see how we can support that innovation and pushing that forward and doing those things. I don't like it if we're always two steps behind and we're trying to fix the things that have already been, you know, released before us. I much better like to take a step forward and go, okay, what are you doing? How are you going to do that? Let's do it this way so we can do it together. And then, you know, we can push it out there. So that motivates me too, is just getting on the forefront of that innovation curve and working side by side with the innovators and removing those barriers of cybersecurity. For so long, we've been the Department of No. We've been the obstructionist. We've been, you know, these, all of these negative things that you associate with cybersecurity. And I guess to some degree, you know, we've benefited from the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that the media tends to focus on, even though it bothers me. At the same time, you know, there's that silver lining you can do something with. And so, you know, it's equative. It's not a race, right? Let's look at innovation. Let's look at cybersecurity. Let's bring them together and let's make a thing happen with them. And from my experience, when you explain it to people that way, they're very much willing to come to the table, because the innovators don't want to have to worry about cybersecurity. And that's really, at the end of the day, my job. My job is to have them not worry about those things. I will worry about them and then tell you what you need to do to also not worry about them.
Give us some concrete examples, if you can, of where that kind of philosophy of security supporting the innovation side and allowing it to go faster, where that kind of in either your current role or in past roles or around the industry, where you've seen that, like specific things where you've seen it take place.
Sure. Well, you know, we look at, for instance, we've got some gene sequencers that we sell, a whole line of them. And we've looked at adapting the technology for those gene sequencers to make it much easier to use in a sterile lab environment. Things like voice activation, for example. So when technicians don't have to handle the instrument, they're not breaching that sterile environment that they're in, right? They're gowned up and they're gloved and things like that. So just that simple feature, voice activation, it's a fantastic innovation, and it could literally change lab space and things that these lab techs are doing. But at the same time, we're building it on technologies that we know are vulnerable, right? We know that speech recognition can be faked. We know it can be intruded. There's all these things in the surveillance society, right? How do we shepherd the information? I'm not necessarily responsible for data privacy, but we have a data privacy office that is, so I have to intersect with them and do those things. So just in that alone, when you talk about adding a feature like voice activation to equipment that you would normally manually touch, what my goal is to get my innovators to think of all the things it takes to get that done, as well as all the things it takes to secure that technology. So these questions don't have to be asked. Or if they are asked, we have a very easy answer that maybe we can produce in a document to say, this is what that is, and this is what that means, and, you know, here's where your data goes, and things like that. You know, very big fan of transparency, and we need to be far more transparent. I think that for years and years and years, security has been, you know, so obscure and cloaked, and, you know, I don't want that anymore. I want it to be transparent.
You talked a little bit about your team before and how there was an intern and somebody that came from Risk, and I know you have a couple more people on here, and it's pretty eclectic. So does that help you? Does it hurt you?
Let me tell you how much it's helped me. First of all, I'm a strong believer in eclectic, being an eclectic person myself. It's a niche that I can definitely get into. But it has helped tremendously, because when you are bringing people from all walks who have completely different viewpoints, this is where we get our security epiphanies. Mm-hmm. And they're incredibly important. I'm going to just tell you about a few of my team members, because they're fantastic. So I told you, I brought a lady over from Risk. She had no what we would call security experience. And she immediately started working with the business, learning business processes, doing all this stuff. And she came to me and she said, I don't really understand the direction I'm going in. And I said, well, let's get you some security learning. So we got her some security training and I mentored her a little bit and we had her paired up with some other folks. And she really now understands the direction she's going in. But what's great is because she wasn't walking the security path, she was really coming at it from that risk management point of view. So that's one thing that was amazing. Another person that I hired. When I took the job, about a month after I took the job, I got a note from a researcher that said, hey, I found one of your public firmwares and I reverse engineered it and it had a poor password in it, which it did. And, my wife works with this stuff, so I just thought I'd let you know. And I said, oh, that's cool. Are you looking for a job? And he goes, I happen to be emigrating from the UK. He and his wife got married. He was emigrating from the UK to the US. And I said, great. Why don't we hire you? So we went ahead and hired him. And he is one of our security researchers. It's a great story. And by the way, that particular issue that he identified took us almost 11 months to solve because of all the regression testing that we had to go through with all the customers that use that particular firmware. It has been solved now, but it was a very, very difficult equation to get through, even though it was a very simple thing to break. But I digress. So we hired him, and he brings just a great sense of wonder and innovation. I call him a kid because, I mean, to everybody's a kid to me, let's be honest. But really, he is. He's got this sort of wide-eyed view of the world, and he's never encountered some of the traditional things that we would see as corporate barriers. So he just goes for it, and he's not restrained by that. So really, to answer your question, I look for all walks. I want good, diverse teams. I do a lot of diversity and inclusion recruiting because I think it's so important. These ideas that we have, again, we talk about the community. We've got to get more ideas from more people looking at things a different way. Sometimes something like an intern can give you such a simple solution that was in front of you the whole time and you never would have seen it because you're so entrenched in what you're doing. I've seen that happen over and over and over in my whole career. And I would never say that that's a small thing because it's not. Bring people in who are diverse. They need different points of view. I'm a very strong fan of non-traditional backgrounds. I have a non-traditional background. I actually have a master's degree in HR. But I work in security and IT and have been for, billions of years. So non-traditional backgrounds are fantastic. Bring them in. We need communicators. I need people with soft skills. Mm-hmm. Soft skills benefit me far more than technical skills do because I can teach people technical things. Or I can hire technicians, or I can outsource tech, right? There's all these things I can do with the technical side, but yeah, I can't outsource soft skills. And those soft skills are so incredibly important. You've got to be a problem solver. Are you somebody who can think your way around a problem and see things just from a completely different point of view? Those are really, really important things that I think not only do I benefit from, but everybody benefits from. And we need more of that in our community. We need more of that just all the way around, just different points of view.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I know that in talking with several other folks, they also want to get more people in from non-traditional backgrounds or, hire the right candidates. But it's sometimes really difficult in big organizations because you've got a whole hiring process. And in order to come in at this level, you've got to have,
you need all these
6 years of experience. So how have you managed to break through all of that and get the people on board that you wanted to get on board?
I love that question because I was going to ask that question. Bring it in. Go.
There you go. So let me say that I am cheating a little bit. When I took the job, top management buy-in was already there. Mm-hmm. And that is half the battle, if not three quarters of the battle, I have to say. We have a CEO at this company who is very supportive of cybersecurity, very supportive of product security, and that is a top-down message that everybody knows. In our corporate goals, we have goal trees where everybody is responsible for certain things. Cybersecurity is a responsibility of every single person in this company in the goal tree in their annual review.
Wow.
It's not a trivial thing. So when I say that and we talk about the message of top-down acceptance, it is an incredibly important thing. However, to your point, We also are bogged down by bureaucracy because we are a 70,000 person company that's, you know, $30 billion. So, you know, we do have our fair share of things. So when people come to interview with us, we do tend to warn them or caution them. This may take us a little while, but we're really interested. So hang in there. You know, I've had more than my fair share of emails going, just give me another week or just give me 2 weeks. You know, we had this process breakdown. We'll get there. We'll do these things. So from my perspective, as you know, I've been a hiring manager for a long time. I've hired a lot of people over the years. And really, it's just that communication. You know, you got to keep that communication with people to get them excited about what you're doing and excited about bringing them on and doing stuff. We do hire here for fit, for culture. It is the number one thing. Over and above any other skill you might have, you must be a cultural fit. And that's a really strong message sent by our CISO. And we adhere to it. It's a thing. So, you know, we have you talk to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that can't handle the non-structured version of security. And that's really what we are in IoT. We are non-structured. And like I said at the beginning, we're flying a plane that we're building at the same time. There's not a lot of rails here. There's not a lot of safety nets. We got to take risks. We got to make things happen. To my company's credit, though, the CEO is sending the right message. My business colleagues rise to the occasion. We have good conversations. We have difficult conversations too, but we overcome. And at the end of the day, everybody realizes the importance of the work that we're doing because that message is being sent. And so if there's something that I can say is, you know, if you are new to this, if you're building a program, the very first thing you have to do is you have to get that management buy-in. It is the most critical thing to do. It's your foundational element you're going to base everything else off of.
Or maybe on the security researcher side and want to engage with a medical device maker. You know, you talked a little bit about that, but like, what's one of the next concrete steps that they can do, you know, even if they haven't found a vulnerability yet, but they just want to start bridging those gaps?
So I think that reaching out is a really important thing. We actually do have a bug bounty program, but it's private. Ours is private in an interesting way, though. I mean, it's not invite only. We don't do invite only. We actually invite people into the program if they report something to us that we deem as something that we want to follow up on, and we'll bring them into our bug bounty program that way. And there are a lot of companies I know that do very similar things. So I would say reaching out and asking those questions. Hey, I'm interested in this. What can I do? How can I help? You know, we have a very public web property that's our big e-commerce platform. There are other companies out there that do too. And so maybe a researcher can say, hey, you know, I'd like to knock around on this thing and see if I can find problems for you and get yourself known and out there. I don't like blind stuff. It worked out with the person that I hired. But blind stuff tends to cause panic, especially if you find something that's significant. On the other side of that, I realize that we now have something that's probably not being recognized as an industry, and that is bug bounties, hunting for bugs, right? This is something that people are doing for a living, and we have to step up to the plate and acknowledge that. So companies have to be able to want to play in that space and want to compensate for that. But it starts with a conversation at the end of the day. So my suggestion is reach out to a company and say, do you have a program? Are you interested in this? What can I do? And just see if you can get to the right person and have those conversations. I'm totally open to that stuff. I love it. But you know, my opinion is others should too.
So I feel like I haven't asked you a lot of questions because as you've talked, you've answered them, which I completely and utterly appreciate. So
it's because I talk a lot.
But it's not that you talk a lot. It's that 90% of everything you say has substance. 90%.
Oh, thank you. 90. Okay, I'll work on that. Thank you.
Precise number.
It's a good high number. On that note, we're going to leave. Do you have five words or less, anything imparting that you want to give to the community?
Please reach out. Let's talk.
Nice. Well done. All right. Well, thank you very much, Joel Cardella from Thermo Fisher Scientific.
Thank you.
We will see you next time on White Hats and Lab Coats, the Biohacking Village podcast.
Thanks for listening to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Find us on iTunes, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Join the community conversation and expand your gray matter on Twitter at @DC_BHV. And get transcripts, links, and show notes at whitehatslabcoats.org.